At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This episode of the BPOS podcast is sponsored by Cuvée Coffee. For 26 years, Cuvée's been Texas' premier coffee roaster, sourcing the highest quality beans, roasting to exacting standards, and delivering fresh and straight to your door. Go to CuvéeCoffee.com and use code BPOS for 20% off your first order. That's CuvéeCoffee.com, code BPOS, for 20% off your first order. Cuvée is for people who get up and get after it, because it's always 5 a.m. somewhere. Welcome back to the BPOS podcast. As always, if you are watching on Spotify or YouTube, listening on Apple, please leave a review, subscribe, all that good stuff. It really helps the podcast out. Today, I'm joined by Robert Hansen. I really enjoyed reading your book. I'm not totally finished yet. Mm-hmm. It is incredibly well written. So I just want to tell you that at the get-go.
Thank you.
Like I was saying earlier, for me, and I get that it's probably, you know, written at a very elementary level, but this stuff is so far over my head that you know, I'll let you know if I don't understand anything and need you to explain it in a little way.
Happy to.
Cool. I am curious, and I subscribe to your newsletter too, which is great, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
What's the R snake?
It's an homage to an old gaming handle, which was The Snake. And then I went to college, and my professor said, well, you have to, you know, create an account on the systems, and it can't be anything weird like Warlock, whatever. You know, it's got to have your name in it.
Okay.
And I'm like, well, you don't know what my middle name is. It could be Snake. You don't know. And so I made it R Snake just to see what would happen. And no one asked me to change it. And so from that point forward, it was R Snake.
Oh, that's funny.
And it's kind of stuck ever since.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, look, we met probably for the first time. It's been a few years, yeah?
I'm going to guess here because I don't know off the top of my head, but maybe like four or 5 years, something like that?
That probably sounds right,
yeah.
Man. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So we met at a shooting class,
mm-hmm.
But, I mean, really didn't know each other or anything like that.
No.
So and then got connected on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I had a podcast of my own that's quite different than this, but I think I was just sharing it a lot, and you were kind of commenting, and we were talking, and then I saw what was happening with you, and then we really started talking again,
yeah.
And that's kind of how we got reconnected.
Yeah.
I'm glad we did.
Yeah, me too, man. I'm looking forward to hanging out the rest of the day.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the name of your podcast?
Well, the podcast is The Arsenic Show.
Okay.
And the newsletter is The Arsenic Report.
Right. Awesome. All right. Well, let's start at the start, man, because I don't know a ton about you other than, you know, what I see in your profile
and
your bio.
I'm a damn good shooter.
Okay. I do know that. I do know that. Yes, absolutely.
No. Okay. So I've been in computer security for... actually, let me preface this for your audience just so we're... because I think people are going to hear this and they're going to go, what is going on with this character? Because I've seen some of your other episodes and your guests, and
yeah.
I really don't fit that mold very well.
Okay.
I am a computer security guy. That is what I am. And so most of what I'm going to be talking about dovetails very heavily into that world.
Right.
And so... I don't want your audience to think that this is going to be inaccessible. It's going to be a lot of weirdness followed by things that are totally accessible.
Right.
So just please bear with. So I have been in computer security for about 29 years-ish right now. And I met this guy, James Flom, like 22, 23 years ago, something like that. So pretty early in my career. And he was an asshole. Oh my gosh! This guy, I mean, he was terrible. I happened to share an office with him, and I just could not break through to this guy. He was
right.
Ice, just absolute ice.
Okay.
And one day, he walks in and he's in a particularly gruff mood about something, traffic on the way in or something. I'm like, good morning, sunshine. And he just starts cracking up. I'm like, oh, I get it. He's like one of those people you just need to make fun of him. I got this.
Okay.
I'm happy to make fun of this guy. So
right.
I just started making fun of him right and left. And all of a sudden, we're best friends.
Interesting.
Like literally best friends.
Okay.
We started hanging out all the time, going on vacations together, like all kinds of stuff, meeting his family, like the whole thing, right? And him meeting mine, and et cetera, right? We're just friends. We're hanging out all the time, you know. You go out and try to pick up girls and the whole thing,
yeah.
Right? You know, you can imagine, best friends. So we also became business partners,
okay.
Which is kind of somewhat critical to the story, because when we collectively moved to Austin together, we lived in the Bay for a while, then we kind of separated. I was living down in Southern California, and then we're starting a business together. We want to move together wherever it's going to be, and we picked Austin. So that's how we ended up in Austin,
okay.
Together as friends,
right?
Best friends. So. That company did not do well. It's one of my biggest failures in life is that particular company.
What kind of company was it?
It was a consulting company. And so we would break into banks and, you know, whatever, you know, Fortune 500s. Our client list was every company you've ever heard of, basically.
Okay.
They're all huge companies.
Right.
And most of them were financial or directly related to finance in some ways. So when the subprime mortgage crisis happened, it exploded. And when that happened, we just didn't have enough capital to keep going, so the whole thing died.
Mm. But your job was to hack their security?
Yes.
Got it.
And also security companies would hire us to break into the security companies because we were so much better than their staff. We would always get in, and they're like, well, we want to kind of future-proof ourselves as much as possible because our clients demand that we don't get hacked into.
So if I can stop you in the story for mm-hmm. a second, I'm curious, how do you become a professional security hacker? Like what leads you down that path?
Well, I don't think either of us were particularly on the white hat side initially. And then we gradually got better and better and better. For me, my why was, I had started a nonprofit around the same time when I was very first starting getting good at hacking, which was a nonprofit to prevent online child pornographers from being able to trade their wares.
Interesting.
And it's hard to be doing that at night and then doing bad stuff during the day. You know what I mean? Like
right.
I couldn't make it work in my brain.
Yeah.
No matter how I tried. So I'm like, well, shit, I guess I'm a good guy now. You know what I mean? Like
right.
I can't do it anymore. And so that was my big change. I think for James, it was a matter of just convenience and money, and it's just the easier path in life. So
okay.
He just went down that path.
All right.
I wish I could ask him to tell you. I don't actually know.
Yeah.
But anyway, we had a really interesting company, and the client list was ridiculous. Like amazing, huge, huge companies. But when the subprime mortgage crisis went down, it's funny, I was on Wall Street when this happened, literally on Wall Street in this tall bank tower. And I'm like talking to this guy, one of our clients, and he's like, they're going out of business. They might be okay. They're probably going to go out of business. They're going out of business. And I'm like, we're in a bank right now. Like, how about you guys? You know? And he's like, well, I can tell you one thing. We're not buying your services for a long time.
Wow.
Like complete austerity. And so that was from the horse's mouth, right? It's like everything got shut down, and we probably had 6 months of cash in the bank. It was not going to work. So the company folded, or mostly folded. I was able to survive just enough to fire everybody in the company except James. James was the one person who was able to stay.
Okay.
He was critical because he was doing some operation stuff for one of the paying clients that was left. So I basically tossed him the keys, fired myself. I literally looked in the mirror, fired myself. I got to tell you, it was the biggest depression I've ever gone through.
Wow.
Up until James died.
Right.
It was really gnarly. And so one of the things that came out of that, which I think kind of leads us into this story a bit better, is I realized I was a very transactional person. I did not actually care about people the same way I thought they cared about each other or cared about me. I was like, I'm running a business. This is a business. Like everybody's, you know, either helping me or getting in my way. Right now.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
And so, and so much so that even when I was going through this horrible depression, I didn't feel like I could turn to James the other person who was in it with me, my best friend.
Right.
Like, I felt standoffish towards him. And so there was a tremendous amount of guilt about that. Like, God, like how, what a kind of shitty person I was. Like, unbelievably shitty. And so I just kind of made a conscious decision I wasn't going to be like that anymore. I like literally reverted my entire life. Like everything I was transactional, I'm like no longer doing that. Like a waiter's, you know, asking me like what I want. I'm trying to figure out what they want in life. You know, like how do I improve them, right? Because I'm so tired of living like that. And clearly it didn't work anyway with the company exploding and all that. But he was still running this company. So he was running it for me, or, you know, by himself at this point, because it's his company now. And it's doing kind of shitty, you know, kind of limping along, you know, because I was the front man. He was the guy, the technical guy. Well, we're both very technical, but he's technical in a different way.
Yeah, operations more.
Yeah, and I'm really good at web application and browser security. He's really good at network and host security, which is sort of different, right?
Okay.
So one thing about James is he is simply the best hacker I've ever met. And I met a lot of hackers. This guy's incredibly good. And I learned a lot from him over the years. I mean, he's so good, like incredibly, incredibly talented. So good, like gigantic security companies, like huge hardware manufacturers will by name send him hardware. Please have that guy work on this piece of hardware.
Wow.
Like they have a team of like 5,000 people building it and they want him to test it specifically.
Right.
That's how good he is. So I didn't feel bad about him running a consulting practice because because he's so good and the world needs this.
Mm-hmm.
They really, really need him. And they need him working on this specifically. They don't know that he exists even. You know, a few people know he exists, but almost no one knows this guy exists. I was the front man. I was a sales guy. So after the company died, anybody would come to me and have anything interesting going on, I'd be like, you got to talk to James. You know, like you should, you know, so I was giving him, it's hard to know exactly, but I would guess probably 70 to 80% of his business at least.
Wow.
So that's important because imagine I'm giving you 70% of your revenue or 80% of your revenue, maybe even more. And now something is going wrong in your life. Are you going to tell me about that? Or are you going to say, I got to protect that revenue source?
You're going to protect that revenue source.
Right, yeah. Right. So to some extent, despite the fact I no longer felt it was transactional, and I wasn't even getting kickbacks for this, by the way. I felt bad. I really, truly felt bad about it. And he was my friend. And I was very concerned about what would happen if he no longer had enough money to survive. Because one thing about dealing with really professional hackers, I'm not talking about the script kiddies, you know, just download some software and run it. This is a whole different variety of hacker, right?
Okay.
It's very novel, the guy you're really worried about. I used to refer to him as a walking nuclear bomb, and I did not mean that in a polite or nice way. I meant, imagine you walked in a 50 megaton nuclear device into a bar and people are slapping it and putting their beer on top and kicking it and moving it around. I mean, would anyone feel comfortable with that?
No.
Of course. And that is literally what we had walking around Austin.
That was James.
That's James.
Wow.
James is the most terrifying person I've ever met in my entire life.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is, if he decided to go rogue, there is literally nothing that would stop him. It's funny because we had a client come in one day, it was earlier, and he said something to the effect of like, what would you do, Robert? What would you do? Or I think he asked James first. I can't remember which. I think he asked James first. He's like, what would you do if Robert went rogue? Like, how would you stop him? He's like, I have no idea. Like, he's Robert. Like, he's going to do whatever he wants. It's
right.
Like, I would never even see it happening. Like, he has other tools in his toolbox. And I was thinking the same thing. Like, if James went rogue, there is no one that could stop this guy. He's terrifying. Like, literally, and he could disappear. He knows all the tricks.
Wow.
You know what I mean? He's an absolute ghost if he feels like being an absolute ghost, right? He knows everything. Very, very talented. And hardware, software, anything, right? Very dangerous person. So I felt obliged to continue to float him as much as I possibly could in whatever way. I do not want the bad thing to happen.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
It's like some guy might be able to go, you know, shoot up a, you know, from a bell tower and kill like 15 people. James could kill millions by turning off critical resources. Like, this is a very, very, this guy would literally be like dropping a nuclear bomb, not figuratively, in terms of damage potential. Like,
that's so crazy.
Like, super dangerous person. It's hard to exactly tell the audience what I mean by that, but maybe they can kind of sort of grasp what I'm saying. So that's the lead up to this, right? This is who James is.
Right.
Brilliant, brilliant person. He's an atheist. He's a stoic. He's a scientist. He breaks things apart and like down to the microns, like one knows what the voltage across something is. Like he's the most scientific minded person I've ever met.
Okay.
By far. Right. So,
and then just so I'm clear, because of his skill set and because he was so brilliant and so good at what he did, if he decided, I don't want to do this to help people anymore, I want to do this to hurt people, or maybe there's more money in it if I'm a bad guy and I use the things that I know.
Right.
Like he could wreak massive havoc.
Undeniably.
Okay. All right.
Undeniably.
Got it.
So that's the lead up to this is James, yeah. Right? Everything about him is tough. You know what I mean? He's tough-willed, he's tough physically. He's tall, he's strong, you know, like everything about him, you just like, don't mess with that guy. Right. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Out of anybody I know, just don't mess with him. Right. So he ended up dating this, girl in town, named Shannon Norton. And Shannon was just about almost the exact opposite of what I expect him to go for.
Okay.
Like, I think he'd go for some, you know, bimbo, blonde, bombshell, whatever, who just was fun.
Right.
That's what I would expect out of James, having known him and partied with him and picked up girls with him for years and years, right? Shannon's not that. She's something else. She's completely different. She's very outdoorsy, not, I wouldn't say, traditionally that beautiful, just, you know, a pretty girl. But,
right.
Taller than I would expect him to go for, just kind of aesthetically very different from every other girl I've seen him date or be attracted to or whatever, and had nothing in common. Nothing other than dogs. They both like dogs. And I think they like hiking, traveling, okay. Hiking, but that's it. That was like literally it. Like anything else he'd talk about with his job or anything he's doing, she'd like completely tune him out. Like, I don't know what the hell he's talking about, and vice versa. She'd want to talk about whatever she like video game thing she was playing on her like iPad or whatever. He's like, well, I don't care. Some soap opera or drama or something she's into.
Right.
They had literally nothing in common. But they fucking loved each other. And in fact, I remember one time I asked him, like, what's the deal here? Like, why are you dating this girl? I don't get it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not mad about it. I just don't. What the hell? It's like, and like, no irony at all. No hesitation. He's like, I love her. Like that's it. You know, there was nothing else in there, which is, I think that's pretty impressive.
It is.
So one thing you have to know about James, backing up slightly, actually, you have to know several things about James walking into this. One thing is that his sister had been killed in a murder-suicide a few years earlier. Mm. It's a really, really tragic thing. I know way too many details about this because I'm James's friend, and
right.
So he shared a lot with me that I will not share on the podcast here, but suffice it to say, he was very beat up about this.
Sure.
And understandably, he's lost his sister. He, in fact, in some cases was worse off than you might expect because, they didn't know what had happened in the house. So they maced the house because they thought that people might still be in the house.
Oh no.
So now he has to go and recover all this shit out of the house, and there's mace in the house. And, you know, so he's being maced while he's cleaning out her, you know, her effects or whatever. And then there was this massive custody issue after with the daughter. And so he basically spent every last penny he had, literally, and then some, and credit card debt, trying to get custody to his sister, basically, try to move custody over, paid for the entire lawsuit or whatever the thing, and managed to win. I mean, he put himself wildly in debt, like tens and tens of thousands of dollars in debt. And he didn't make that much money. So that was significant for him. So that's important because kind of imagine the sort of person he is, right? He's like really cares about his family, really cares about what had happened. It affected him deeply.
Sure.
Right. In every way, financially, emotionally, like this is, he took it hard,
yeah.
Right? One other thing you need to know about James, which is kind of seems off-piste, but it isn't. This is all related. Is that he was in football earlier in his life. And also before I met him, something had happened, and the details are very murky. He got hit on the back of the head by something and he doesn't know what the something is. He was walking down the street one day, got hit in the back of the head, and hit so hard that he woke up in a pool of blood, and he couldn't smell anymore.
Oh, good God.
Right. Yeah. So that's a kind of a weird set of things. But actually, I thought he was lying to me about the smell thing for years. Years, I thought he was lying to me. I'm like, that's not true. That did not happen. You know, absolutely horseshit, yeah. Right? And so I would do all kinds of things, like leave like horrible smelling things around, like just kind of fucking with him because yeah. I thought he was fucking with me. But one day, the real thing that made me realize it wasn't true, that was true, was I walked into his apartment and it's like the worst, most overpowering scent of mold I'd ever smelled in my life. I'm like, what is wrong? He's like, what is it? And I'm like, you don't smell, like, how do you not smell that? He's like, I can't smell, dude. I'm like, oh, actually, that's true. You really can't smell.
Yeah.
What had happened is a carboy of beer had somehow broken or something in his closet. And so it created this massive bloom. It was
yeast and mold.
Yeah. Oh, it was awful.
Yeah.
Awful smell. And, you know, one of those, like, you got to tear everything out sort of situations.
Ugh.
So it's true. He had a really traumatic brain thing happen, so much so that he lost his sense of smell. So we kind of, I wouldn't say exactly drifted apart, but I got super busy doing other things. He was trying to run his company, and for a variety of reasons, I just don't think we could quite get our lives organized to hang out as much as I would like for quite a while, actually. Well over a year. And one day I get a message from him, and it's over Signal, which is a secure messaging app for those who don't know. And we use ephemeral messaging, so I wouldn't even be able to show you this message, but you're just going to have to trust me. It was this weird, blurry looking scene. It was like very strange, like kind of like a parking lot. There's like kind of blues and reds in the background, kind of brown on the bottom. Really hard to tell what was going on. And it just basically said, like, I'm really sorry. I love you, brother. You know, like,
it was a picture.
It was a picture with some text below it. And I'm like, what the fuck? So I'm calling him, trying to get a hold of him, not answering. So I call Shannon. And it took her a couple of tries. Finally got her. I'm like, what is going on with James? She's like, what do you mean what's going on, James? And I'm like, texted her this thing. I'm like, what the fuck is this? And she's like, oh, I have no idea. And so we do all this research, try to figure out where he is at. Turns out he's somewhere back east. He had this RV and he was trying to move it. They're trying to move out of Austin. They're going to move back east somewhere, Virginia, I think. And he was... this is part of the process of him moving, was moving all of his stuff in advance in this RV he had.
Okay.
And this stupid fucking RV that he'd been working on forever. He has all these like partially done projects. And then this way, this is very bad because the RV was partially done and had no air conditioning. So he had gotten really gnarly heat stroke the night before. And something, so instead of, you know, being a normal human being, going, hey, maybe I should like figure out what's going on with the air conditioning and like stop and not do this again. He gets back in the vehicle and makes it to some like gas station or something. It doesn't put it in park properly and it starts rolling in such a way where he runs over to the vehicle, tries to jump in, and it smashes him on the front and back of his head. So think of two concussions, kind of bam, bam, and then falls back onto the concrete, third concussion. And he wakes up in that context having these massive hallucinations, and he thinks people have called his phone and threatened or said that they had killed Shannon, and then he thought his life was over and he thought people were after him and he thought he was dying.
Oh my God.
So it was a horrible, like, just random bad thing that happened to him. So the cops thought he was on drugs. They were convinced, so they put him in a loony bin for like a week or something. Tried to like do all these blood, like super advanced blood draws on him, whatever. Totally clean. There's nothing, not even alcohol in his system. Completely clean. So he comes back to Austin, kind of tail tucked between his legs a little bit, like, I kind of fucked that whole thing up there.
Right.
You know, it was supposed to be a real easy, you know, thing. And so from my perspective, that seems like a weird but isolated incident, right?
Yep.
A very strange thing that happened, but isolated and totally explainable. You know what I mean? You had heat stroke. You know, it's a weird, it's super weird, but it's totally explainable.
Right.
You know what I mean? So fast forward, I don't know, maybe a month or so. And I get a call from Shannon, and she's like, James is, something's going on with James. I don't know what it is. Something weird's happening with him. I'm like, okay, can you give me some details? Like, and so we start talking, and she says, well, he's having these really bad hallucinations. And I'm like, okay, well, do you want me to do something? She's like, no, I just want to let you know. I'm like, okay, do you feel safe in the house? And she's like, yes, I think I'm fine. I'm like, okay. Keep me posted, you know, let's talk tomorrow or whatever when you know more, because they're doing tests and stuff. So day goes by, and she calls me, and she's like, actually, Robert, I don't feel safe in the house.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, okay, well, I'll come and take all the guns out. So you won't have any guns in the house. At least that'll be one line of defense. Do you need to stay with us or whatever? She's like, no, I'm not that way. I just don't want guns in the house. I'm like, great. So I took all the guns out. So fast forward another day, and now he's out. So they cleared him. And so he, again, very sheepishly, he comes back to me. He's like, look, I know that seems really weird, but actually what happened was I was detoxing off alcohol. So he had been drinking a lot, like a lot, like a lot. And to the point where he was getting shakes when he didn't drink, you know, the whole thing. And that, you know, that sucks, but it's a thing that is separate from everything else we've talked about. Right. And he's like, well, I just decided to quit cold turkey. And apparently one of the things that can happen is you get really bad hallucinations when that occurs. I'm like, okay, that makes sense. And he's speaking to me as lucid as I'm speaking to you right now.
Right.
Completely normal, back to the way James always was from every minute I had spent with him up to that point, right? Completely normal. So I'm like, okay, that is also a weird, very strange, but also totally isolated and explainable circumstance.
Not alarming enough to dig any deeper.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it's isolated. Right. It has nothing to do with a car accident 2 months earlier, yep. Right? Those things are separate data points, separate things entirely, right? So fast forward another month, and it's the last time I see James alive. We had a Christmas, sorry, man. We had a Christmas with him, and he was totally lucid, like completely just like we are right now. Mm-hmm. Like, just he's... just a normal guy, and he didn't drink, which I thought was weird because he always drank, but it just kind of proved, like, wow, he's back, you know, he's like the old James is back, but somehow better even, you know what I mean?
There's tissues, yeah. Right down there too. Yeah.
And he'd actually been gaining some weight back because he had been a little bit thin for a while. I was worried about him. I thought, you know, there's a million things it could have been. But he also has weird workout routines he's on, right? He's always doing weird shit. He's a kind of a biohacker. But he's gaining some weight, color back, you know, which is great. I attributed that to not drinking. I'm like, this is great. Like, this is a healthy person. You know? He's smiling and happy and, like, no warning signs whatsoever. So fast forward another 3 months. So I hadn't seen him once in that 3 month period. Like I said, we were kind of like ships in the night a little bit. Our paths weren't crossing as much as they used to. And I typically go to this conference called RSA Conference in San Francisco every year. There's a couple of big security conferences, Black Hat, RSA, this one in San Francisco. So I go to it, and it's the most opulent, decadent thing, like all these security vendors spending, you know, untold millions of dollars to court people. It's the most over the top display of money and power and influence that I think I could possibly come up with.
Interesting.
And so while I'm there, you know, eating fancy meals and, you know, being in fancy hotels and, you know, seeing places from the fanciest parts of these buildings. And, you know, just imagine, right?
Right.
Most opulent. I'm on in a cab ride on the way home, and it was Uber, rather. It was an Uber driver. And we're just chatting about, you know, the conference and, like, how things were. And I'm kind of depleted from the conference.
Trade shows will do that to you. Yeah.
And so I'm talking to him about it, and I get this phone call from a number I didn't recognize, but it was an area code. It was in Austin. And I had a weird feeling about it. Normally, I wouldn't bother answering, but I did have a weird feeling about it, so I answered it. And no accounting for feelings, right? Just what it was. And it was this woman who I had met like once before, and she is one of Shannon's friends, maybe twice, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe. And she proceeds to tell me that James and Shannon were found dead in his in their house where they lived. It's actually her house. And my initial instinct was, I don't trust this person at all.
Mm.
I don't know this person at all.
Right.
So, like, every alarm system went off, like, do not trust, do not, but verify like crazy.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And so I called my wife. I'm like, right after I got off the phone, I'm like, I need you to drive over to James's house right this second. And by the way, to her credit, she was super worried about me doing this interview. She called me. I was talking to him earlier. She called me before I even arrived, and she's like, how'd it go? Like, and I'm like, it hasn't even started yet. I'm like, I need you to drive by. So she drives by with my stepson, and there's ambulances out front and the whole, you know, news crew and the whole fucking thing. And so it turns out the friend, she had been worried about Shannon, hadn't, because normally she texts back really quick. She's,
right.
She's good. James is horrible, but she's good, right? And she hadn't been texting, which is very unusual. They went by the house, you know, like, it seems like people are home, but no one's answering. So she finally called the police, and they went and investigated and found their bodies. And they had been there for something like 3 to 4 days.
Oh, my God.
So the entire time I'm living this opulent, you know.
Right.
It's so completely antithetical to what was happening elsewhere, you know, in the world, in the universe. Okay, so... So I fly back to Austin. Well, actually, I'm about to get to the airport is really what's happening. And you know, because it's a big conference, I mean, it's a huge conference. It's like 40,000 people or something. Maybe it's 100,000. It's huge. It's huge conference. Invariably, and I'm well known in my industry, so invariably I'm going to see people I recognize in the airport.
Yeah.
This is unavoidable, right?
Right?
So I'm traveling to the airport, and sure as shit, I ran into somebody who's like a good friend of mine, and he's like, oh, let's hang out in the airport. It's great, you know, like someone to chill with, and I'm just like losing it, right? Like, holy fuck, you know? And he knows James, he knows me, doesn't know James that well, and he's just like, what do I do with this guy? Like, you know, so awkward. I can't imagine what it was like for him sitting there listening to me. But then on the airplane, I had an entire airplane ride that I kind of had to try to hold it together.
Yeah.
It was pretty miserable. I gotta tell you, get back to Austin. And already by the time I'm landing, the family is booking flights and coming in. Right. And they're meeting me. I don't have access to the house. It's cordoned off, you know, it's a crime scene, and police are calling me, asking me questions because, you know, I'm his best friend.
Right.
In fact, of anybody alive, I had the most context of the situation and the people and everything, right? I knew about his business dealings. I knew about her. I knew about the house. I knew about the dogs. I knew everything, right? And Shannon wasn't nearly as complicated as James. James is just a mess. Like, there's all kinds of weird things about this guy's life.
Right.
And he had other companies and stuff. And I knew about all of them and a lot of backstory and stuff. So the cops wanted to ask me some questions. And so the brother, his brother Alex, and his sister, Jenny, they flew in to Austin. And they had nowhere to be or stay or whatever. So I'm like, just stay with me.
Right.
And so I have the family now staying with me. And now they're the ones who need access to the house, but it's Shannon's house and it's a murder suicide situation. And there was some confusion at first about whether it was or wasn't or whatever. And it actually took quite a while to get confirmation. And in fact, there was fake news, not fake news, but misreporting anyway, that said it was a double homicide as opposed to a murder suicide. So then it was like, oh, shit, is there a murderer on the loose that's killing my friend? Like, and that would almost likely be of the two, he's much more likely to be killed by somebody. we did a lot of amazing research together, so I would not be surprised if somebody somewhere had a vendetta, you know what I mean? But this, that wasn't what happened. It was a murder-suicide. So anyway, the family needed access to the house, and now I'm in the middle of coordinating kind of a massive investigation, if you think about it, because we still don't know at this point, like, did it happen and this way or that way or whatever, and there's so much weirdness about this because there's never been any conflict between them that we'd ever seen. Like, the family had never seen it. I'd never seen it.
Right.
Shannon's family had never seen it. So it's like, where did this domestic abuse come from where he'd start shooting her and himself? Like, it doesn't, it's right. not congruent with anything we know about him. So it seemed like the double homicide thing might be real for a while. So anyway, we finally got access to the house and the family wanted me there. And some weird morbid part of me wanted to be there too, you know?
Yeah.
But I remember I was telling his mother who was there, is, you know, can you imagine this woman's lost two of her kids through murder-suicide? Just imagine. I
No, I can't.
Right. And so she was staying with us as well at one point. I think she came in a day later maybe or something. I can't remember. It's a little fuzzy. But anyway, so we're about to go into the house, and one of Shannon's maybe cousins, I think, is ex-Special Forces. So he really wanted to be coming from Shannon's side of the family. And Alex, you know, he was deployed with the SEALs. So two strong military guys wanted to be sort of lead into the house. And for many reasons, I was still the coordinator of the, you know, the quarterback of the operation.
Right.
And so I'm like, you guys need to, like, double check, make sure the house is clean and clear for the family to go in, like, open all the windows, because I'm sure there's a lot of really horrifying chemicals and stuff going on in the house. Open up all the windows, make sure it's aired out as much as you can, then we'll all go in. So there was a moment when we're outside waiting to go into the house, and I'm sorry, this is a really morbid...
it's a crazy story.
It's a crazy story. So, his mother is very religious, and so she said, "I know you're going to find whatever you need to find on this computer." And I'm sitting there thinking, "This is the best security guy I've ever met in my entire life."
Right?
You've got to be fucking kidding. I mean, she doesn't know what I know, but
right.
there is no way anyone's getting anything off of any of his computers. It is a literal impossibility. There is no computational power on Earth capable of decrypting the kinds of encryptions he's using and the way he's using them. It will even be hard to tell where the encryption is. That's how good he is at this stuff.
Okay.
Like, this is next level shit, right? So I told his mother, I'm like, I think it's very unlikely I'm going to get anything off this computer at all, like anything. And she grabbed me about as hard as an old, very upset woman could. And she's like, Robert, I've had my entire church praying that you'll be able to get that stuff off the computers, because they really wanted a bunch of family photos and shit off his computers. And I'm looking at her and I'm like, oh man, this is going to be really brutal when she realizes there's nothing.
Right.
There's nothing to be done here. We go into the house. I walk down the hallway. I walk down into his office around the corner. And by God, that computer's unlocked.
Wow.
I mean, the chances of him doing that by accident are zero.
Right.
It's impossible. On a normal day, in a normal situation, it is literally impossible. And I'm sitting there with complete access to everything. It's impossible.
Right.
It cannot happen. You know what I mean? Like, this is just impossible. And there was even some screens open. Like here, go look here kind of things. Like, his mail was open. One of his chat windows was open. A box where he runs commands was open. Like it was all available to me. And I'm just absolutely shocked. And I start realizing, you know, because people are now starting to text me. Like, people are finding out about it online. One of his friends, sort of a mutual friend, I guess, much more of his friend, texted me and basically said something to the effect of, I've seen weird declines in him over time. Apparently about a week before, he had gotten really, really bad COVID, like super, super, super bad, hospitalized. And he said he lost an entire day of his life, just gone. Those types of fugues are very uncommon. And in fact, they don't happen in COVID. So that is not a symptom of COVID. That is something completely different.
Okay.
but I didn't even know what was happening. Like, I was, like, completely unaware that that was even going on. And we started putting the puzzle pieces together. One of the last things he had searched for on his computer was pictures of his sister.
Oh, well.
Who had, you know, been killed murder-suicide. And then it comes out that one of Shannon's sisters had been warned or had been told by Shannon that she was very, very worried because he had been hallucinating, not that there was two random incidents totally
got it
isolated, that he had been hallucinating. So we look at the house, we see what's going on. It's very probable. We don't know for fact, right? There's a lot of details that we just probably will never know.
Right.
But we believe that he was hallucinating when he shot her. He had been hearing some kind of voices, so it was an auditory hallucinations. As you well know, somebody who shoots, if you fire a gun indoors without ear pro, I don't care if you're hallucinating or not, you're going to fucking notice that.
Right.
And I suspect that probably sobered him up at least momentarily enough.
Oh.
To realize what happened. Because at this point, you can actually see him, like the almost the ghost of him walking through this house, hitting walls and going through the house and then finally killing himself, oh, like two rooms away. So, I mean, the house is just awful, like really awful. And I mean, they did their best to clean it up, but you know, there was like rotting smells and all kinds of horrible shit, even with the doors open, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
It was fucking horrible. So what we know now is that the auditory hallucinations were almost certainly related to concussions he had when he was in football, getting hit in the back of his head when he was, you know, in his 20s or whatever, where he lost his sense of smell, the three concussions he received, the alcoholism, COVID / whatever caused him to have this thing, which was causing massive amounts of insomnia. He was working no less than 80-hour weeks,
yeah,
on average, sometimes much more. And with all his other, like, life responsibilities. So imagine he's not sleeping, period.
Right.
And when you don't sleep, guess what? You get hallucinations. So, pardon me. So now the question is, what gun did he use?
Oh, that's right, because you had taken all the guns.
Well, I had, but there was a time later on that James came to me. It was maybe 3 weeks later or something, came to me. He's like, hey, Robert, he's sheepish, you know, like, I know I really fucked up here, but I'm totally okay. Can I have my guns back? And I said, yeah. I mean, this was never punitive.
Right, right.
I was never, like, trying to hurt you or, you know, say anything bad about you or your mental well-being, but you were clearly going through this, you know, alcohol withdrawal thing, and Shannon didn't feel comfortable, so yeah, no problem. But here's where I stop feeling like this is just like someone else's story, and now it's my story again, because I didn't ask Shannon if it was okay to give him those guns.
Right.
Right? And so, and I knew I should. I remember thinking the second that phone call came in, because he was going to come over later that day, I remember thinking the second I should call Shannon before I answer one way or another.
Yeah.
And I didn't do it. Now, I was very busy that day, or at least that's what my mind tells me I am right now. Like, right now I can tell you I had a busy day that day. But I don't know if I had such a busy day I couldn't make one phone call.
Right.
I don't know that that's true. I feel like it's true, but I don't know it's true. Like, is that me trying to cover up the sin of not giving her one fucking phone call? Because that might have changed the whole course of this thing. Because if I had heard her saying, no, he's still having hallucinations, this is completely unrelated, do not give him the guns back, I would feel very, very different about my actions and the counter reactions. Fast forward almost an entire year, and I was talking with his sister, because I'm still involved. Like, you know, I had to be involved because the court he didn't have a will, so I had to be the testimony and the estate and all that stuff, go to the court. And what I realized, but and when talking to her, is she said something like, "Well, they didn't know which guns belonged to who." And being his best friend, I had shot every gun he owned, and I had had every gun he owned. But one gun that I didn't ever take was her gun. I never took her gun. That's her gun. She wanted her gun, and she wanted it by her bedside, and that's her gun. She wanted his guns taken. So they asked me, like, well, which guns are which? And I'm like, well, that one's Shannon's. And I'm like, and then they said later, well, I'm glad that I don't have to worry about having to sell a murder weapon. And I'm like, well, what do you mean by that? And she's like, well, Shannon's gun is the one that was used. They identified it. I'm like, I am not responsible for that gun. I didn't even really think about the gun, to be honest. I, you know, just was sort of out of my mind.
Right.
I was so concerned about the guns I was taking out of the house. I wasn't thinking about guns I wasn't taking out of the house. And so that was, that was a really interesting moment because I was suddenly wildly relieved that something I had been holding on for an entire year turned out to not have anything to do with me. Or at least that component didn't have anything to do with me. If I had called her, maybe she would have said, yes, I'm still stressed about him. And I'd gone, why? And then I would ask the follow-on question and things would have been different, but it wouldn't have been related to the gun one way or another.
Right.
So despite the fact I still feel pretty guilty about it, that one aspect, which was the one I was most upset with myself about, was gone. And it's weird. Like later that day, my cat died and it's like I went through this massive grief and then like a few hours of like, holy shit, my life is just so much better. And then immediately after that, my cat died. And I'm like, same day.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, that's the universe just putting me right back where I belong.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more to the story, but I think that's sort of the high level of it.
Yeah.
The family and I stay in touch, sort of gained a family out of the deal, you know what I mean? And they gained a brother and a son, but certainly no replacement. And it's funny because he's so baked into my life in so many places, like servers. Like I was running this company. We eventually sold it to a publicly traded company called Tenable. Made a nice little payday on it. Everybody's happy. But the infrastructure was still controlled by James. And so when he died, I'm like, holy shit. Like, there's nobody manning the ship over there.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, nobody. There's no backup at all. And normally James would be plenty. But we don't even have the passwords.
Wow.
So I have to unwind this massive infrastructure and, like, there's all these little things. I'm like, okay, I'll just call James. And, you know, it's like, there's nobody there, you know. Huge chunk of what I used to, I used to offload my memory because I know that James is more capable at this one set of tasks that I wouldn't bother knowing the thing.
Right.
Like, it's just like, it's easier if I just have James handle it. And I want to pick up the phone. Like, I'm like ready to dial his number. I'm like, oh, fuck. Like, he's just not there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so that has been really, really rough on me, I'll be honest.
Yeah, I can totally understand. It's a crazy story. And just to, well, I think there's two things that I'm taking away from this. One, you know, like it sounds like he probably had TBI or something along those lines.
We think he had CTE.
Oh, okay.
Which is a type of brain trauma that basically fits every single one of his symptoms.
Got it.
And it's the kind of brain trauma you get if you're a soldier or if you're a football player or martial artist.
Uh-huh.
And you get a lot of brain trauma, and it's a degenerative disease. There's no test for it. You'll often see soldiers start, you know, going to the bottle, you know, doing a lot of drugs, and you'll assume that that's the underlying condition, is the drugs or alcohol,
right,
or the PTSD that caused them to do it. But often it's actually this CTE that their brain is literally turning into like mush. And the only way you can really know for sure is by examining the brain postmortem. And guess what? I don't have access to when he shoots himself in the head. And so we really don't know for sure, but that is the by far the most likely when you look at the list of symptoms right. that we have collected since then.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
The other one is, it's just, you know, communication, right? You know, like you were talking about, there are certain things that sometimes you're just not comfortable sharing for whatever reason. And I talk a lot about this in grief, and I've learned a lot about this in grief. Like, you just have to get comfortable being uncomfortable, you know, and having uncomfortable discussions. I hear what you're saying about the guns and feeling guilty and all that sort of stuff, and then, you know, feeling relieved. At the same time, it sounds like, you know, if Shannon had just reached out to you and said, man, you know, this is what's happening, you know, as his best friend, you'd have been there.
Or fucking James.
Yeah, well, yeah.
God, yeah. I mean, come on.
Yes.
So, like I said before, he's very stoic. This is actually going to dovetail into this book, I think. So I wrote a book. I'm not trying to pimp my book. I don't even make money on it. But the goal in writing this book was to explain something about James while I'm explaining something about AI. So the three qualities you could describe as James: hyperintelligent, stoic, hallucinates. What are we building? We're building something that's hyper intelligent, super stoic, doesn't believe it needs any help, and hallucinates. That is really, really terrifying, because as we've seen, James was a walking nuclear bomb, and thankfully only two people died.
Mm.
That's the best possible outcome. I mean, it could have been so, 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 so much worse. And I just don't think people are quite thinking both the technology aspect of this, but also how we interact with one another. And one thing I do know is you can't have stoicism and hallucination at the same time. You get to choose one.
So when you say AI is hallucinates, what explain that to me?
So if you ask it to explain the Accords of 1921, where the British and the United States did this thing, and you start drafting what you think the Accords were and give me your synopsis of them, it'll start doing that like it's a real thing. That's not a real thing. I just made that up.
Oh, interesting.
And what it's basically, it's more sophisticated than this. I don't want to underplay it, but it's more or less text complete. So it's trying to find the nearest thing to whatever the thing is. So if I say, I'm going to pet my dog, and cat are very likely to be the next word. What isn't likely next be the next word is wall, right?
Right.
So it will kind of more or less roll a dice. It's a little more complicated than this to decide which one you probably mean based on all of the variables present.
Got it.
And so it's really great at being creative within the confines of all creativity it's ever seen. You see what I'm saying?
Okay.
Somebody like James does not have that problem. Their problem is they invent whole people, things that don't exist at all. In Gemini's world, it'll create a black person who that thinks is the founding father, or black people that were Nazis right. in Germany.
Right.
So it's inventing a scenario based on the parameters it's given. James is hallucinating because of biochemical problems, short circuits in his brain, similar things that are happening, and both believe they're correct.
Right.
Both are unwilling to ask, does this look right to you?
Hmm.
And that's the problem, is they don't believe the externalities are important. Now, they'll say they will, but they don't.
Yeah.
If you intellectually query them on that, and they will definitively tell you, yes, these things matter, but they don't. In reality, they don't. They know that they are the master of their own domain, and they can do their own research. They don't need your help. You don't get to be stoic and hallucinate at the same time. I'm sorry. And so if you are aware of anybody hallucinating, you are morally obligated to take control.
Yeah.
And that's, if I had known what I know now, knowing what kind of friends we were and the crazy experiences and times we've had, like all over the world, all kinds of crazy, crazy stories, hacking into banks and, you know, flight control systems and water power, like all kinds of crazy stories I could tell you, crazy stories you would not believe. Me sending him into a hurricane, like literally, like, I need you to get on this plane right now to fly to Florida. And he's like, we're not even cleared. I'm like, you're cleared to get on. Like, crazy stories. I would have not let him even leave the house.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure I'd have let him use a computer. But I know I would have sat on him. I would not have let him do anything that would have harmed himself intentionally. Yeah. Because that's who I felt I needed to be around, a fucking nuclear bomb.
Yeah.
And if you're not going to protect society from that, like, bad things are going to happen eventually.
Right.
Right. And the really scary thing is, James is the most terrifying person I've ever met. And now I'm the most terrifying person that I know. I'm not kidding you.
Okay.
Which is a really odd sensation. Like, I used to, you know, one of the benefits of caring about other people is it gets you out of your own head. You know what I mean? You're allowed to offset. The selfishness. This isn't about me. I want to help this other person. I care about them. I want them to succeed. I want them to be healthy. I want them to have a family. I want them to, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But when that person is no longer there, all you can do is navel gaze and just examine your own self. And the kind of person I could have been that I wasn't, you know?
I understand. At the same time, you are that person now, though. And it's, yeah, it's terrible that a tragedy like this, you know, is partially the catalyst for it.
It's funny. The day I woke up to publish this book, the night before, I did not know I was going to publish it. But I was so tired of thinking about it, of having it just eat away at me, and then publishers deciding whether they do or don't like it based on commercial viability or mm-hmm. whatever. I'm like, you're censoring something that absolutely has to get out. And I don't give a shit who buys it, but it can't live in my computer. That's not the right place for this material. It has to exist elsewhere.
So what is the overall purpose of the book? Was it partially therapy for you, or is there...
It kind of ended up that way.
Yeah.
So I'll give you an example of how it's used, which might give you some clue. So one of the largest companies on Earth that no one's ever heard of, called WWT, they're, I think, the biggest, or very close to, the biggest buyer of NVIDIA chips on Earth,
okay,
which are used heavily for AI. They require their AI team, anybody who's going to work on AI, to read my book.
Interesting.
Because it gives you context for how frail LLMs actually are in the face of bias.
What's LLM?
A large language model.
Oh, got it. Got it.
So anytime you have anybody who wants to put their finger on the scale, it's very easy to manipulate it and make it do bad things. And you might be thinking you're doing it for good thing, for good reasons. You might be thinking, oh, I want to save the kids. I want to save the whales. I want to protect people from, you know, harming themselves, et cetera. But what you're really doing is you're lobotomizing it. And there's, I could say, 1,000 things about that. But one of the most important things about lobotomizing something is it is no longer a fact-finding thing. It is now something else. And when you do that to something that people rely on, serious people, I consider myself a very serious person. When I need an answer, I don't need some Silicon Valley part-time computer scientist's opinion of what the answer is. I need the actual answer. And very serious people are starting to embed it in some very serious systems. And if those systems, for instance, I'll give you an example of a real thing, not a fake thing. A buddy of mine is inventing some software. He's gotten pretty far along. He's here in Austin, that is designed to identify mass shooting. And so he wanted my help to basically create a lexicon of things that are very likely to mean that you're about to commit mass murder. So one of the ways to do that is you start asking, you know, an LLM, like, give me samples of all kinds of different, like, I want to kill people, I want to kill myself, I want to blah, 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 the world sucks, et cetera, right?
Yeah.
And it literally won't do it. It's like, please call for help. I'm like, I'm not in trouble. I'm trying to build a thing. It's like, I can't help you. Now imagine instead of manually doing this, I had just decided that it's good enough as is and plugged it directly in. And then people are starting to send things across the wire that's saying they're going to murder somebody or going to go shoot up a town or whatever. Well, it's going to go, I'm not even allowed to process this data. So not only is it not going to identify it as the bad thing, but it won't even process it at all. It'll say, I can't do that.
Hmm.
See the problem?
I see the problem. I'm just, like I told you, man, I think maybe my head is just too thick to really understand. It's so...
Don't worry, much inferior people are working on it. No, I'm not kidding.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's... Okay, so the book is, I get it, you know, it's part, you know, reliving your story and maybe helping yourself through that, but it's also...
And being a better friend.
And, yeah, good message. I like that. I like that a lot. I think, you know what, I'm just sitting here thinking on all my shortcomings as a friend. You know, when I think I'm a good friend, when I really could be so much better. So
much better.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think that's a really important message. But then it's also, this book is, it's to teach people that there are some red flags out there. Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly didn't put all this detail into the book. So if you're listening to this, don't expect to hear this in that book. But my editor was making a very good point early on. He's like, you're talking about James in this, and you're alluding to this super intelligent person.
Right.
But you're never really telling his whole story. Like, what is his whole story? It's like you kind of talk around it, but you never really say it. So I told him the whole story. He's like, Robert, you can't hold back. You've got to write this the right way. And he was right. My editor was completely right. And so I ended up having to basically rewrite the whole goddamn book. Honestly, I think there was like one chapter that could be saved, but the rest had to be rethought. And I feel better for it, because what I was really trying to get at is I failed as a friend, completely, demonstrably failed. But there's redemption, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And it's funny. Normally I wouldn't say this on a podcast, but I'll just tell you because I don't care. But we call our house the Lighthouse. This is a bit of an homage to J.D. Cameron, who's James Cameron's younger brother. So J.D. was one of my best friends. He passed. And he named all of his houses after boats. So I felt like as a nice homage to him, I would name the house Lighthouse.
Okay.
But I treat it like a place where people can go when things are going wrong. So a buddy's going through a divorce, you know, someone's really having a horrible time at work, you know, some bad things occurring. They have a place, and it's my place. And, you know, stay here for a day, stay here for a month, I don't care. Just, like, I want you to get better first.
Yeah.
Then I'll shove you out. But with, you know, renewed wings, with a better outlook on life, maybe better contacts that you didn't have, or better way of thinking about it, whatever it is, you know, or just distance, time. for me, I think the thing that healed me the most, other than finding out that I didn't have anything to do with the murder weapon, was time. Yeah. Just time. You know, it just took a lot of time.
How long ago did this all happen?
March of last year. As I said, I gained a family out of the deal. Yeah. And so we've talked quite a bit, you know, helping them out from time to time on different things. And, you know, sometimes just, you know, Merry Christmas or whatever, you know, like it can be nothing and still be something. And, I like what Tim Kennedy said on your episode 5 there. Like, there's a right and wrong way to grieve. And I was grieving alone. I was doing it by myself. And not intentionally, not really even noticing I was doing it. But, for instance, we had a pool that we were making. And it was leading up to us, my wife and I, getting married. We're getting married. I'm releasing a book. I'm launching a VC firm. The house is a shambles because we're building a pool and a deck and whatever in preparation for the wedding. And I'm out there having to water the pool. It's a typical thing you do to heal up the concrete so it doesn't crack or whatever. But it's like a 2-hour thing, or it's like 1 hour twice a day or 3 times a day or something like that. I can't remember. And I'm just out there just by myself for hours or whatever every day.
Right.
With a way too much time on my hands. And what are you doing when you're watering? It's not like it's intellectual exercise, no. You know? So I'm having way too much time to process what's going on. I'm coming in just like wrecked just from watering the pool. And I think it was that point my wife she really saw what was going on. She's like, I just don't feel safe with you. You know, not like I'm going to hurt her, but right. Like, I don't feel safe with you being alone. Like, you need to have people around, like, for a while, like, at all times. You're going to have someone babysitting you kind of going forward.
You know, that's, I can tell you from my own personal experience, my darkest moments, you know, this past year have been when I'm by myself. Absolutely, without a doubt. That is 100% real.
Yeah. It is.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. My dad, maybe like 3 weeks later or something, like, my life was a wreck for a month. Because the family was there and all this shit was happening and, you know, the funeral and, you know, people traveling in and out of town. Like, I just had no time.
Yeah.
Like, no time. Like, not even a minute to myself kind of thing, like using the restroom and then back at it. You know what I mean? Like,
yep.
I was super busy. But then all of a sudden I wasn't, you know what I mean? Like, I just wasn't busy. And my dad, I finally had time to like hang out with other people. So I saw my dad. He's like, everything going okay? I'm like, well, no, it was pretty fucked up. I hadn't started grieving at all yet.
Yeah.
Like, I had no time for it. I mean, maybe a couple of minutes here and there, maybe, but then something would happen, and the family was going through a lot of crisis amongst themselves, as you might imagine.
Sure.
Just, it was horrible, and they're in my house. And so after it's over, he's like, should I take your guns away from me? I'm like, Dad, that was 2 weeks ago. But the funny thing was, I hadn't even started grieving yet.
Right.
So in a weird way, he was kind of right, but it felt stupid. I'm like, why didn't you ask me that when my friend died? Like, why did you wait till now to do that? But in hindsight, it probably was like another month away before I really was actually in distress.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I finally had time to slow down. And the book that was most helpful for me, by the way, for anyone asking or thinking about this, was The Obstacle is the Way.
Okay.
And it's a Stoic book. And all the other things I read just didn't resonate, because it was like, you know, you're so much in grief, you can't get out of bed. I'm like, that's not me. I'm hyper efficient. I'm like up and at it, and I'm doing all kinds of shit. I'm super, super busy. I've got all kinds of things going on. Stay in bed. Who's got time for that shit?
Right.
I wasn't okay, but that wasn't my problem.
Right.
So all the books I was reading are like, you know, you're just going to not want to leave the house today. You're not going to want, I'm like, no, that's not me at all. Like, it couldn't be further from my situation.
Yeah.
So none of that resonated. But The Obstacle is a Way did resonate, because basically what it was saying is, you can't stop the train. You just can't. It's a train. It's a train. It's super big. But you might be able to redirect the train. And in redirecting the train, there might be some advantage. There might be something you can learn or get better about or whatever. And so the book is one of the things that came from that. Mm-hmm. It's like I kind of poured myself into being productive in any way I could be productive. And I bought myself a lot of time, like a lot of time. So I was able to grieve, but much more sporadically over time. I mean, every time I pick up the book, it's pretty rough.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll be honest, I try not to because it's rough. But it also is a gentle reminder to me because it's kind of like there all the time in the background. People want to talk about it in the podcast or, you know, it'll come up in a bio or something, right? So it's sort of always there. It's the gentle reminder that he's there kind of in the background. It's funny. I don't exactly believe in ghosts or whatever, but I've had some very fucking weird things happen, like bizarre, weird things. Like, I'm pretty sure J.D. Cameron's been haunting me for years. It sounds so weird, super, super weird. But like, books will fall off bookshelves sometimes, like straight out of some like horror movie or something. And I'll pick up the book, and it's like the fall of Western civilization or whatever. And it's like been on a shelf that hasn't moved. Nothing about this room moves. Like, what the hell's going on? And like, it happened multiple times. We actually got one of them on camera. We're all just like, what is going on?
That's
like,
crazy.
It's very strange. But I had this dream with James. It was so realistic. It's just so unbelievably like he was there. And he basically just said, stop worrying, you know?
Wow.
And, you know, like, get on with it kind of thing. Like, there's nothing you can do about it now sort of deal.
Right.
But I think he's wrong. In typical James fashion, he can be stoic and wrong. Because I think there are things to be done. For instance, there's this app that exists that's about when someone's, like, giving birth or something, the community will come together and, like, it's not particularly helpful if everyone shows up at the casserole the same day.
Right.
That's not, everyone thinks they're doing a nice thing. Really, it's a pain in the ass. You just made my fridge life a nightmare.
Right.
And now I've got all this stuff that I got to get these pans back to you. You kind of made this person's life bad, not good. And they're already stressed out. So instead you're like, what do you need? And you put all the stuff you need. There's 20, however many meals in a week. I need somebody here for each one of those meals just to like hold down the fort, bring one meal, just enough for us, nothing crazy.
Right.
And then, so now it's like divvied up by all these people. I love that app. I think it's a great idea. I'm spacing the name of it. My wife would be like, shh, look, it's obviously named whatever it is.
It's Meal Train.
Yeah. I think it is Meal Train. Yeah. Good memory. But I've long thought there should be, a similar app for this issue. Right.
Okay.
So we have a friend who's in distress, but between you and me, let's say it's Jeff. We know Jeff together, right? Jeff's in distress. We both care about Jeff. We don't want a bad thing to happen to Jeff. His wife knows way more things about Jeff because she spends more time with him.
Right.
But so does his, you know, filmographer, or so does, you know, somebody, his coworker or whatever, right? So all these people know about Jeff. Some of them know him quite well. Some of them only hang out with him once in a while. And I'm like, look, Jeff started tripping. I don't know what it is, but it seems like he trips a lot. Has anyone else noticed that? Is that a, and you're like, actually, yeah, he tripped like 3 times last week. I didn't really think about it.
Yeah.
And then 5 other people are like, oh, wow, no. And then someone's like, yeah, it started around this time when this thing happened. And everyone's like, oh, that's what happened. And then someone else is like, no, I saw it a week before that. It's like, okay, not related. And we can start narrowing it down to the neurological time or the symptoms or whatever, where you're like, Jeff not even in the conversation necessarily, could be, you know, if it's not like a adversarial thing, like drugs might be an adversarial situation. But it's like, when did this occur? You know, or like someone starts getting an emotional distress. You're like, was this related to them leaving the girlfriend or not leaving the girlfriend? You're like, actually, no, I saw him crying like a week earlier. Remember, his dog died too. It's like, oh, the dog, that was the thing. Like, let's go back in time and that might be more related to what's going on there. Let's ask questions about that. And,
right.
But if you're going to build up a timeline to hand to a professional, like an actual, a psychologist that can actually prescribe drugs, or a doctor who can actually start looking in the brain and see what's going on, or other neurological things that might be happening, you know, lupus or something, right? Something on the body is failing. Now you have a really nice timeline from tons of people's perspectives who all give a shit.
Right.
And then you can do meal train. Then you can do all this other stuff and start helping this person.
Yeah.
But you can't do that with one person alone caring. I mean, it kind of sort of works.
Yeah.
But nothing like the power of the community.
Yeah.
And this is what we lost by not having the church anymore. This is why communities being separated so far is not a great idea. Social media is not as helpful as it should be because you're not really seeing the same person every single day. This is why men die so rapidly after their wives die, because they don't have somebody looking at them going, hey, there's something wrong with you. You need to go to the doctor. You know, they're just, I'll be fine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not just heartbreak. It's right. It's pure logistics of no one caring about them on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
So I think James's ghost is wrong. I think there's something to be done here, and I don't give a shit what he thinks. He's dead now, so I think there's a lot to be done.
Well, and you're doing stuff, right?
Trying.
So, yeah, it feels so weird, and it's so hard to say. You know what? You know, let's talk about something good that came out of such a horrible tragedy, but you know. It sounds like there are a couple things, you know, you becoming a better person.
Better friend.
A better friend. Yeah, absolutely. And then, yeah, the way you're thinking, man, it's it can be very meaningful. So I thank you, man. I thank you for coming in and sharing this story. I know it was hard. I feel that. I mean, I feel that big time. But
I appreciate it, brother.
It's important.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thank you.